The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, your radio home for programs like All Things Considered and Morning Edition since 1985. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, July 13th, 2017. The weekend is approaching, and with this particular weekend, opportunities to learn about some out-of-the-ordinary activities. Tomorrow night, an informal conversation with artists in Fayetteville will reveal how to fold glass, create visual puns, and select engaging colors. Artists discussing their work include Ed Pennebaker, glassblower, and Leilani Law, visual artist and painter. The event is at the Walker Stone House in downtown Fayetteville. It is free, and it begins tomorrow night at 6:30. Saturday, the Scott Family Amazium in Bentonville is celebrating a second birthday with activities including water bottle rockets and more. You can find out the details at amazium.org. Ahead on this Thursday edition of Ozarks, a decades-long tradition continues this weekend in Springdale with the opening of the summer musical from Art Center of the Ozarks. We'll talk with the director of Kiss Me Kate. And Elizabeth Margulis, director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, explains perfect pitch isn't as rare as once believed. First, Arkansas's civil rights code lacks specific protections for LGBTQ residents. In 2015, the city of Fayetteville created an ordinance prohibiting such discrimination. In February of this year, the Arkansas Supreme Court ruled the city was in defiance of Act 137. That's a state law banning such laws that Fayetteville passed. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the state's high court declined to rule if that law is rational, leaving that decision to a lower court.
Arkansas Civil Rights Act prevents discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, gender, and disability, but not sexual orientation or gender identity. 3 years ago, a number of Arkansas cities began to draft civil rights ordinances to correct this, prohibiting discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodation. Then Act 137 was passed. It annulled a patchwork of municipal civil rights ordinances across the state. Any business or organization, it said, is subject to uniform non-discrimination laws and obligations. Republican State Senator Bart Hester sponsored the measure. He said businesses began fearing litigation.
I did have a lot of businesses come to me and say this is a concern that we can be accused and therefore we are guilty. De facto guilty of a civil rights action at any time.
In the summer of 2015, Fayetteville City Council approved an inclusive civil rights ordinance, which voters later ratified. The city code exempts churches as well as religious institutions. Opponents of Fayetteville's civil rights ordinance sued the city and county court. Judge Doug Martin ruled in Fayetteville's favor. The matter was appealed to the Arkansas Supreme Court, which reversed Martin's decision and ruled against Fayetteville. But in an unexpected twist, the High Court returned the case to Washington County Circuit Court to decide if Act 137 is constitutional at all. Hester says no one from his district has ever come forward with a civil rights complaint, but Fayetteville attorney Kit Williams says many LGBTQ residents testified on the record during the drafting of the ordinance about being ostracized at work, on the job, and in public spaces.
And so that there was really some fairly well-documented incidents that I was surprised had occurred in Fayetteville, and I was sorry to hear that that kind of discriminatory behavior, in fact, had happened.
Since the ordinance was codified, William says he's gotten a few complaints, but none worthy of a hearing before the city's new Civil Rights Commission. The new code, he says, which remains in place pending the circuit court decision, appears to be working. Hester, meanwhile, points out that laws already exist protecting the rights of gay and transgender Arkansans in domestic violence and anti-bullying state statutes. Plaintiffs in this case are Protect Fayetteville, a group of citizens who opposed the ordinance. Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge is intervening on the state's behalf. Defendants are the city of Fayetteville, including Mayor Lionel Jordan, and members of city council represented by city attorney Kit Williams. Judge Doug Martin has granted the American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas a request to intervene on behalf of a local gay organization and three LGBT residents. Holly Dixon is a legal director of the ACLU.
As residents of Fayetteville, they receive, you know, direct protection from the ordinance. And so they stand to be harmed if this state law is allowed to eradicate the protections that they worked so hard to get into place.
Nearly 20 states in the District of Columbia, along with 200 municipalities, have anti-discrimination laws and ordinances inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. Dixon disputes the plaintiff's argument that municipal civil rights ordinances are myriad and therefore onerous. But Bart Hester says there's another group that deserves protection, those who must make decisions that align with their religious beliefs.
I want an individual to be able to practice his religion outside of church, in his business, at his home. I want them to be able to practice their religious objections at any time.
Judge Martin has set a September deadline for both sides to collect and exchange information about the case and to file briefs. Dixon says it's not clear if this will be a bench or jury trial. And no matter the outcome, this case will likely be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Support for Arkansas Public Media comes from the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas that provide reliable and affordable energy to more than 1.2 million members across Arkansas. More information at ecark.org.
That report was created in conjunction with Arkansas Public Media, a journalism effort funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and public radio stations in Arkansas. You can learn more at arkansaspublicmedia.org. President Donald Trump has referred to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, as the worst trade deal ever. However, business leaders in Arkansas who seek to expand trade with other countries don't see it exactly that way. The president has since scaled back his rhetoric, but in May, the Trump administration sent a letter to Congress notifying lawmakers of plans to renegotiate the trade agreement. That's why the Arkansas World Trade Center sent a representative to Washington, D.C. in the last few weeks to a public hearing, so Arkansas's position on NAFTA would be noted. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek has this report.
In trying to redo something like that could become a potential hazard for Arkansas, because right now it's working. We don't know if it's redone, how it's going to work for Arkansas.
That's Melvin Torres, the director of Western Hemisphere Trade at the Arkansas World Trade Center. On one of the last days in June, he went before the U.S. Trade Representative's office to testify about why NAFTA works for Arkansas businesses.
I have had the privilege of working with many of these companies as they do business or seek to do business in markets throughout the Western Hemisphere. These companies perfectly reflect companies all across Middle America.
Torres says Canada is Arkansas's number one foreign trade partner, and Mexico is number two.
Exports from Arkansas to Mexico have increased 700% since NAFTA was implemented. Exports from Arkansas to Mexico are growing 3.6 times faster than exports from Arkansas to any other part of the world.
Torres says Arkansas also exports twice as much to Mexico and Canada as it imports from those countries. He says the World Trade Center had a little over 2 weeks to put together a report it could bring to the trade representative's office. But it reached out to 50,000 Arkansas companies to survey them about their experiences with NAFTA. Torres says more than 150 companies responded. Here he is speaking to the panel in Washington, D.C. about what the Trade Center survey found.
Our companies recognize there is further room for improvement related to how they do business. These include standards, harmonization, enforcement of labeling requirements, clarification and consistency of classification and customs procedures.
Torres says that while the Trade Center is wary of a complete renegotiation, that doesn't mean NAFTA shouldn't be modernized. In 23 years, NAFTA hasn't changed a whole lot, while the world has.
We definitely need a modernization on e-commerce. We need a modernization on anything that has to do with technology that has evolved since 1992 that was not available back then, but it is now.
And while Arkansas sells a lot of products to Mexico and Canada, Torres says the World Trade Center would also like to see Arkansas companies be able to sell more services in those countries. So the modernization of NAFTA could also help in that regard. Here he is again testifying in Washington, D.C.
Additionally, they would be better able to enter these markets if they could provide services. If various services, such as the sale of commercial insurance, photo imaging and 3D printing engineering, design consulting, tax and accounting services were eliminated, the companies would become competitive in the global market.
The survey found companies would also like to eliminate what they consider to be burdensome rule of origin, certificate of origin, and import licensing requirements on certain products. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
When the Trump administration sent the letter to Congress in May, both Mexican and Canadian leaders said they welcomed the opportunity to update the agreement. The letter also started the 90-day notice period the administration is required to give Congress, so any renegotiations of NAFTA cannot begin earlier than August 16th. And any major changes to the agreement will have to be approved by Congress before they can go into effect. Ahead on Ozarks, for decades, the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale has taken note of summer by producing a musical. This weekend, that tradition continues.
So I went to the New York Library and watched the Broadway production first and got a really good feel for how complicated it is and how hard it is for actors, and then fell in love with it there.
Kiss Me, Kate, the first ever Tony winner for Best Musical, is the latest ACO summer musical. We have a preview ahead on the show. And later tonight on 91.3 Of Note with Katie Hendrickson, our locally produced show with hand-picked classical music. Tonight, a pair of longer pieces on tap, Schubert's Trout Quartet and a Strauss Tone poem. Of Note, every Sunday through Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on 91.3. Rainfall amounts in Arkansas through the first half of the year are above normal. Fort Smith, through yesterday, has more than 9.75 inches above what is the norm for this state. Fayetteville, close behind, about 9.72 inches above normal. Harrison in north central Arkansas, also more than 9 inches above the usual rainfall amounts for the year to date. The chances of adding to those rainfall amounts this weekend do exist, but they're relatively small. Throughout the region, we have a 20 to 40% chance of showers or thunderstorms developing at some time between now and Sunday afternoon. It will be hot, though, no doubt about that. Highs in the lower 90s for much of northwest Arkansas the next couple of days. Temperatures reaching in the mid-90s for the Arkansas River Valley with heat index readings of up to 107.
This week on All Things Considered, Republican senators are back in Washington trying to find a path forward on health care. Plus, from Chicago.
I cry sometimes because I see my son running, walking, and now.
What happens after a shooting, stories from the front lines of that city's gun violence epidemic. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
This afternoon from 3 to 6 on 91.3.
Celebrating 21 years in Northwest Arkansas, Community Clinic has served as the medical home for thousands of insured and uninsured patients in Northwest Arkansas, providing health care in 14 locations, including Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, Fayetteville, Lincoln, and Prairie Grove. Healthy people, healthy community. CommunityClinicNWA.org. The Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the region's daily newspaper, offers local news where we live, play, and work in Benton and Washington counties. It's one newspaper for one region. The Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, online at NWADG.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The chancellor at the University of Arkansas, Joseph Steinmetz, will serve as the presiding co-chair of the Northwest Arkansas Council for the next year. He became a member of the council's executive committee soon after arriving in Northwest Arkansas in early 2016. The council has used a rotating one-year chair system for the past 10 years after there were terms by Alice Walton and John Paul Hammerschmidt in the early days of the council. The Libertarian Party is a new political party in Arkansas again. The designation has been made official by the Arkansas Secretary of State's office after enough valid signatures were examined by the office this week. The petition process had to be followed for a fourth time because the Libertarian Party did not get 3% of the votes cast in the governor's race, a threshold any party must meet to not need to submit signatures to be on the next series of ballots. With the ballot spot assured, Libertarian Party officials say candidate recruitment is next on the agenda. U.S. District Judge Christine Baker is to hear oral arguments today on a request to temporarily halt several soon-to-take-effect Arkansas laws restricting abortion. Chris Hickey from our partner station KUAR in Little Rock has more.
Baker will consider a request for an injunction in the lawsuit brought by an obstetrician gynecologist at Little Rock Family Planning Services, an abortion provider. The doctor, Frederick Hopkins, is represented by lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Reproductive Rights. The groups are challenging several laws passed by the Arkansas General Assembly this year. One, the Unborn Child Protection from Dismemberment Abortion Act, bans a common type of abortion procedure performed in the second trimester, known as dilation and evacuation. The others restrict abortion based on sex selection, require abortion facilities to maintain tissue samples of aborted fetuses, and amend the law on disposal of fetal remains. The plaintiffs have argued that the laws would make it virtually impossible for women to get abortions in many cases. Lawyers for the state have argued the laws promote respect for human life while safeguarding patient safety. In Little Rock, I'm Chris Hickey.
Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan is joining 49 other mayors, asking the Federal Communications Commission to maintain net neutrality rules. Mayor Jordan is the only Arkansas mayor included on the letter that was sent to the FCC yesterday, the day of action observed by supporters of net neutrality. Net neutrality disallows favored access to any internet provider or service. Mayors from New York, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and Seattle also signed the letter. The Bella Vista Library is $150,000 closer to an expansion. Yesterday, the Friends of the Library presented a check 2 years before that organization's self-imposed deadline to raise the funds.
That's Kansas City saxophonist Bobby Watson from his new CD. We'll hear from more Kansas City musicians like vocalist Lisa Henry, plus pianist Laszlo Gardoni, and much more this week on Shades of Jazz. I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host every Friday night from 10 till midnight and Saturday morning from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Shades of Jazz right here on KUAF.
Detecting perfect pitch has long been considered a rare skill. However, new research is challenging that commonly held belief. Elizabeth Margulis, professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and two colleagues at Tel Aviv University in Israel, conducted research on perfect pitch and published their findings in the journal Music Perception in June. Margulis recently came to Studio 123 to discuss the study with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. The researcher began the conversation by defining pitch.
If you think about a piano keyboard, you think about when you press the different keys and they make different sounds. That's it. So pitch is, you know, the how high or low a sound is. Think of it that way.
So what's perfect pitch?
That's a great question. So probably all of us have that one person we know who, you know, there's a vacuum in the background and they're like, oh, they're vacuuming on an F sharp. And so that ability to just, without any special context, just know exactly what pitch a sound is making is called perfect pitch or absolute pitch. And for a long time, a lot of estimates about it put it at about 1 in 10,000 people. So said that it's a really, really rare, special ability.
I knew it in the context of being rare, and since I didn't know what it was, I assumed I didn't have it.
You know, it's interesting because in the past few years, I mean, the classic text for absolute pitch relies on some kind of musical training, because how would you know that sound is an F sharp
exactly,
unless you had, you know, some kind of lessons? So people have been trying to devise ways to identify absolute pitch in the absence of that labeling ability. Mm-hmm. And now that they've kind of devised some tests like that, it does turn out that some people who don't know that they have absolute pitch really do have that kind of enhanced pitch memory.
I just don't have the vocabulary for it.
Yeah, I mean, for some people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, probably not.
And possibly you.
Possibly, maybe not. Do you have perfect pitch?
No, absolutely not.
No.
In fact, it's funny. My little sister and I were both really serious pianists growing up, and neither of us have perfect pitch. And my brother, who, you know, couldn't care less, never could stay in a music lesson for more than 5 minutes, flawless, perfect pitch, like very frustrating.
Is it something that can be taught?
So that is I'm sure whatever I say about that is going to result in some listeners feeling feeling frustrated. To my knowledge, there is no demonstrated program that we know can teach people to have perfect pitch. That doesn't mean there aren't 10 million of them out there on the internet that purport to be able to do that. And you know, we do know that early training on an instrument seems to be important. So there's some kind of possibly critical window, some plastic period when you're little, when you can acquire it.
So if it's a commonly held belief that few people can do it, why did you decide to research that?
Yeah, great question. So so what I've just given you is the standard account. And over the past few years, there have been a couple of isolated studies that have kind of started to poke holes in that and suggest that something else might be going on. And I'll tell you a little bit about one of them. And so this was a study that played people familiar theme songs from television shows, for instance, The Simpsons. And they'd play people two versions of that theme song. One was the original one you heard on Sunday nights or whenever that was growing up. And the other was a slightly transposed version. So it's the same theme song, but they just made it a little higher or a little lower. I mean, by a very, very slight amount. And they asked people to detect which was the original. And it turns out that people were actually really good at that. And for that to be the case, they would have to have some kind of memory of the absolute pitch at which, you know, those theme songs were played. So that's one piece of evidence. And then the other one that's really interesting is that if you just stop people on the street and ask them to sing really familiar songs, like you ask them to sing Hotel California, and then you record all the pitches of their starting pitch that just all these random people on the street use. And then you go back and look at the actual pitch in the song Hotel California. Most people are pretty close. So again, some evidence that maybe there's some kind of representation of absolute pitch there, that it's not just arbitrary. And I mean, if that doesn't seem surprising, like, let me just remind you that if you're at a birthday party and, you know, people start to sing happy birthday, that can happen anywhere in the pitch range. You know, sometimes it's really awkwardly high, sometimes it's low. And that's really not a big deal for us. Most people, like, that's called relative pitch. Like, we recognize a song wherever it starts, as long as it has the same interval. So it goes the same amount from note to note. We recognize it, we can sing along. It's not, you know, really a problem. So this idea that we have this absolute pitch representation is the kind of new surprising thing. So what we did is we took this really classical paradigm in music perception research, which is was developed by Krumhansel and Kessler a couple decades ago to show that people have relative pitch, to show that people know when you're listening to a lot of the songs we hear out there in the world, that they kind of have a sense of where the resting pitch is. Like, you know, when you're hearing a song, you kind of know, okay, that's a point where we can be done. That was good. Whereas, oh, you can't stop there, right? That's a really that pitch feels like it needs to resolve to some other pitch. And those are very intuitive kind of feelings that people can have outside of any knowledge or training in music. And to really show that people had these representations, they would play people a tonal context, like a scale or a little chord sequence, and then they just play an isolated pitch, and they'd say, tell me how well this pitch fits with the context you just heard. And people gave remarkably similar answers to this across, you know, wide stretches of people. And they knew that kind of what music theorists call the tonic or the home pitch, like C if you're in a C major. People know that fits well. You play them a C major scale and then you play them a C, people are like, yes, that goes really well. Whereas if you play them a note that's not present in the key, they'll say, oh, that doesn't fit well at all. So even, you know, they might not have had any violin lessons or anything. That's really a task people can do. Okay, so that's the background of the research that's out there. And there's just tons of studies using that paradigm. It's really well established, the kinds of responses people have. And our only innovation was to come in and not only use context that was in a familiar key, like G major. So that's a lot of white keys on the piano. A lot of songs are in G major. A lot of bluegrass songs, especially around G major. but and then we played did the same task but with another context that was in a key that's not used very often. And so you could call it C sharp major or D flat major, but something with a lot of black keys that just it's hard to play, it's hard to read, and there's not a lot of songs written in that, and you don't hear a lot of them out there in the world. And when we asked people to perform just that same classic task, they performed differently in the two keys. Huh. So even though it should be, when you're listening to G major, you know, G fits the best. When you're listening to D flat major, D flat fits the best. There was this lingering effect of the notes in D flat major being weird. So they didn't think they fit as well, even though the key is trying to suggest that now these notes you hear less frequently are, you know, work in this context. People weren't fully buying it. And that suggests that even though they couldn't tell you that was a G major context, this is a D flat major context, they have some implicit knowledge of that difference. They're like, something's weird here. These things aren't fitting. And in fact, the less musical training people had, the more susceptible they were to this difference, possibly because they haven't been trained into relative pitch in the mm-hmm. same way formal training kind of accomplishes in musicians. The sense of that these pitches were just strange and unfamiliar was really evident in their responses. And we actually know why that might happen, because we have other good evidence that people track the statistics of the sounds they hear in their environment, so they know which ones are familiar and which ones aren't. And so that's a possible mechanism here. They just recognize that, you know, these pitches are unfamiliar and these pitches are ones they've heard more frequently. But again, that you know, demonstrates that they can distinguish in this task anyway between common white key pitches and less common black key pitches, which, you know, suggests there's some kind of enhanced pitch memory or absolute pitch representation going on in these people that are not 1 in 10,000 absolute pitch holders.
Were you surprised?
We were surprised, yeah. And then we were kind of excited about it because we had a second experiment in the same paper where we just changed the task slightly. So it was the same thing where they heard a context, they heard a note, but now instead of asking them how well it fit, we asked them how tense the note was. So backing up for a second, when yeah. people think about emotional responses to music, they often talk about certain points feeling tense and certain points feeling relaxed.
Okay.
So think about listening to a song where there's a moment that's really fraught or there's a moment that's just kind of chill. And individual notes can really do that. So this is the kind of rating people were making. And we saw again there in these sort of more affective responses, so something kind of that seems fuzzy, like how tense does this note seem? They were rating familiar notes as less tense mm-hmm. and less familiar notes as more tense. And so when I say familiar, I mean out of like all the music they're likely to have heard.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we know that is because there's cool corpus studies that go, you know, use digital representations to tally up all the notes in
really?
Various bodies of literature and how frequent they are and whatever. So so then there's this interesting link between these quasi-absolute pitch representations and aspects of the feelings people have about music. You know, how the music really feels to them. So this kind of gets at something that seems mysterious to us. You know, why does this music make me feel intense and this music makes me feel calm? And in this very simplified experimental setting is demonstrating that knowledge we don't even know we have about how common or uncommon a pitch is actually feeding into that experience.
So the people listening to notes that maybe they weren't as familiar with, they thought those were more tense.
Yeah.
Doesn't that kind of make sense that in a lot of times in life it's like you're afraid of the thing you don't know or
Absolutely.
You're unfamiliar with?
Yeah. Yes. No question. And I think music plays with that a lot. So we'll have these kind of unexpected or rare events and kind of involve you into the music and then resolve them in a way that – kind of settles the tension that it elicited. And so I think some people talk about music as kind of choreographing your expectations in that way.
So where do you go from here? How do you build on this research?
Well, we're interested right now, especially broadly, about sort of this kind of skills people without formal musical training have that they don't know they have. So lots of times when I tell people what I do, the first response is, oh, music, I don't know anything about music, you know? And that response always surprises me because often you ask a few more questions and that person has like a giant record collection or, you know, they go to all the concerts that come through town. I mean, so clearly they know a lot about music. Like you could not go have the experiences they're having without a lot of implicit knowledge. And I'm really interested in getting at those underlying representations that make experiences, powerful experiences possible outside the context of formal musical training.
Any specific studies you have set up or thinking of?
Yeah. Well, so we're excited that we got a 3-year grant from the National Science Foundation to study people's narrative experiences of music. And this is an idea I really got from my students because, you know, I teach this class that's about kind of scientific approaches to music. And on the first day, I always want to show them how complicated this is going to be and, you know, how dangerous it's going to be that we're going to just reduce everything and it's way more complicated than we can really capture. So, you know, what I thought was this brilliant pedagogical technique was to play them this orchestral excerpt and kind of ask them all afterwards what their experience was like. And the point was that they would all be totally different. And then we'd say, look, this is so subjective and varied. You know, forget it. How are we ever going to do this? And instead, you know, person after person would raise their hand and be like, I heard pirates. There's a big storm and pirates. And so, you know, one semester I was like, okay, they all just picked that up from each other. And then I made them write it down. They're all like writing down pirates, you know. And it really took me, because I, you know, I guess I'm dense or crusty or something. But it took many semesters before I really believed not only that people were having these powerful kind of narrative experiences while they were listening, but also that there was some real overlap between the kinds of the concrete details of the experiences they were having among people. So then we spent a few years trying to figure out methodologies to study that. And now we've got the grant to go use these methodologies and look at people here and look at people in several remote villages in China where both will be listening to both kinds of music, so Chinese and Western music, and we'll be kind of examining the roles of nature and nurture in these story kinds of experiences of music.
So why China?
Well, so we needed a place where we could find certain populations that would not have had exposure to Western music. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard and expensive and complicated to carry out this kind of research. But I have a longtime collaborator, Patrick Wong. So we used to be on the faculty at Northwestern together, and now he's at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. So we were able to work it out with a class there that is going into these remote villages and documenting dying languages. And we were able to get in with that group to run these studies.
One more question for you. Can a vacuum actually be an F sharp?
Sure. I mean, you know, there's two, you could think of, there's some sounds you hear that you can't identify a pitch from, like white noise, stuff that sounds like shh.
Yeah.
Because there's all this energy at a bunch of frequencies that don't kind of resolve into a single primary one. But vacuum cleaners are sometimes pitched and people get can identify the pitch.
Okay. Well, I'll go home and see what I come up with.
Yeah, you know what? And if you listen to yours, you're curious about your vacuum cleaner's pitch, you can download one of those apps like ClearTune on your phone that can tell you what pitch you're listening to.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go home and do that and let you know.
Enjoy.
Well, congratulations on the publication of your research and thanks again for coming in.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.
That was Elizabeth Margulis, professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at the Carver Center for Public Radio earlier this month. Her research on the prevalence of perfect pitch was published in the June issue of the journal Music Perception. In about 4 minutes, this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal examines two growing economies, Northwest Arkansas's and China's, and one way the two are linked. 4 years we've known Midsummer has arrived when the Arts Center of the Ozarks musical hits the stage. Well, Midsummer is here tomorrow. The ACO beginning tomorrow night is going back nearly 60 years for Cole Porter's Kiss Me Kate. This week, Coleman Ray Clark, the director of the production, came to the Carver Center for Public Radio.
we've got a gorgeous set that all moves and rotates and flips around, and the cast is doing all of the transitions and everything. And the story is of the on and offstage relationship of a theater in Baltimore in the 1940s. So we have actors, playing characters who are all rotating the set and moving costumes and changing pieces. And so it's not an ordinary show for an actor to run, because each person is actually used quite a bit and no one has quite much downtime at all.
How is that for you as the director? I mean, is there a comparable experience for you for a show like this?
No, I haven't. What's so wonderful, I will say, though, is that getting a group of actors like the ones that we found in Northwest Arkansas for this show and who came out and auditioned, everyone is someone who is ready to step up and make a strong choice and to follow through with it. So as a director, that's a dream, because I can show them the world and show them this is where you'll be exiting, this is where you're entering, and then where they go in between that is all up to them. So it's really been enjoyable because of the people. It's been more of an exploring kind of process versus a strict this that way kind of thing.
This is a venerable show. I mean, Broadway. Mm-hmm. and how familiar with it were you before you took on this assignment?
I was not familiar with Kiss Me, Kate at all. I knew a couple of the numbers, being a musical theater student and that kind of thing, but really I wasn't familiar with the show. I started doing research on a lot of different musicals and looking at what we could do, and looked at ACO's history and started from there and started trying to think of new shows that hadn't been seen in a while at ACO or hadn't been seen at all, and Kiss Me, Kate has not been seen at all at ACO. So I went to the New York Library and watched the Broadway production first and got a really good feel for how complicated it is and how hard it is for actors, and then fell in love with it there.
Do you think there's an advantage that someone can come to, you know, a decades-old musical? It was the first one to win the Tony for Best Musical,
yes,
after all. And maybe it's better if you're not, you know, just bored with it, or not that you'd be bored with Kiss Me, Kate, but you know what I mean.
Absolutely. And what's particularly interesting, I think, is that our cast, we have several cast members who have done this show before as well. So not only do we have audience members that know the show well, but we have cast members who do know it just as well. And so it's been a great process to stop and break down the script and decide what it means for us today in Northwest Arkansas, what it means for us in Springdale, what it means for everyone involved. And that is what changes, and that's what keeps everything new and fresh every time. So that's been the most exciting part. It is a wonderful show to bring the whole family to. There are laughs and joys for people of any age or any color, shape, size. It really is it's about bringing a community together. It's about what it means to be partners in a relationship on stage and off stage. And so if you want to take some of the summer stress off and come and have a couple of good laughs and enjoy the people around you, this would be the perfect way to do it.
Coleman Ray Clark is the director of the Art Center of the Ozarks production of Kiss Me, Kate, opening at the ACO in downtown Springdale tomorrow night. You can learn more at acozarks.org.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Today we'll discuss a new trajectory of growth for Northwest Arkansas if workforce needs can be met. Also, a closer look at a study abroad program to China offered through the University of Arkansas's Office of Study Abroad and International Exchange. And it's never too early to talk back-to-school shopping. More on that topic a little later. But first, though, everyone's favorite topic, the Northwest Arkansas economy. If it was a professional athlete, you'd think it necessary to test for steroids or other performance-enhancing drugs. But it's all natural. If you consider it natural for a relatively small metro area to be home to the world's largest retailer, one of the world's largest food companies, and the state's flagship university. Our cover story in the latest issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal takes a look at some of the impressive economic indicators from the first few months of 2017. Sales tax revenue, hospitality collections, residential construction, and home sales. They're all up, but will the growth continue? Find out what several regional economists have to say about that and what will help keep the growth sustainable. You can find the story only in the Business Journal. Check out the digital version for free at nwabusinessjournal.com. This is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. China is the world's second largest economy, so from a business perspective, it's a very important country. At the University of Arkansas, students in the Sam Walton College of Business have the opportunity to gain some real-world exposure to the country through a program called the International Business in China Study Tour. The faculty-led program is now in its fifth year and is offered through the U of A's Office of Study Abroad and International Exchange. China is one of a couple dozen countries where students can take a study abroad trip that's sponsored by the U of A. In addition to business and cultural site visits during the three-week trip, students gain insights from non-Chinese business professionals who have chosen to make China a primary part of their career path and now live in the country or travel there extensively. John Kent, the director of the Supply Chain Management Research Center at the Walton College, is one of the faculty leaders for the trip. Kent, in fact, recently returned from the latest study tour to China. He spoke with Business Journal reporter Jeff Della Rosa about some of the program highlights.
During our time in China, we visited several cultural locations like the Great Wall, Tiananmen Square, Forbidden City. We visited Shanghai and the business district there, but we also incorporated visits to several companies while we were there. As many people may know, Walmart has a big presence in China, and we visited with Walmart, toured a distribution center of theirs. We also like to visit China-based companies while we're there as well, because for not only for the faculty that are involved, but for the students that are involved, it's very interesting to get a Chinese culture woven into the management style of the company. When we go to visit Unilever, which we did, or visit Walmart, which we did, still very interesting to see how they operate in China, but still a multinational company, and from a management style can be different. This was the fifth year that we have organized and brought students for a China study abroad. Students learn the cultural aspects, but they also learn the business aspects of doing business in China. I mentioned a few minutes ago about the visiting Chinese companies. One of the companies that we visit in Shanghai is called YTO Express. Depending on how you look at the rankings, they're the second or third largest express company in China, and their primary focus is on e-commerce business, and they're partly owned by Alibaba. So that's a very interesting company for us to visit. We toured their nightly sorting process for e-commerce packages, and we also attended a management meeting that was held at their company and made a presentation, but they also had managers that made presentations, so provided the students an opportunity to see Chinese management style. The time that we're there is structured in a few ways. Part of it is classroom time, which that's not free time. Part of it is the business visits, that's not free time. Part of it is cultural visits, and that's a little bit of free time, certainly more of a, hey, I'm going on a trip to China. However, I would say the favorite city that of the students that we visited was Hong Kong. I think it's probably because it's the most westernized of the cities that we visited, but whether it was recreational, we happened to be there for a holiday that's called the Dragon Boat Festival. The students wore their bathing suits and went down to the beach and watched the dragon boat races, and so that was certainly a free day and a fun time, I think, for them. So that's sort of a day kind of example. Whether it's Hong Kong or whether it's Shanghai or whether it's Shenzhen or Suzhou, those are the major cities and Beijing that we visited. There's a nightlife that's associated with all of those cities, and probably the two most famous would be Shanghai or Hong Kong, and certainly understanding and enjoying that aspect of the trip in the free time part, I think the students would highlight.
For more on that program, be sure and read Jeff's story in an upcoming issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. When we come back, we'll talk back to school spending and what retailers are expecting this year. Don't go away.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom, providing voice and data solutions that adapt to today's demand with tomorrow's technology. Communication tools that integrate mobility with the desktop and merge wired networks with the wireless technology. More at one-comm.com or 479-715-8800.
The summer has only just begun, it seems, but retailers from Walmart to Target have already started preparing their stores for the busy back-to-school season. Retail sales hit nearly $76 billion last year, and a new report predicts that number will rise about 4% this year. The report also found the two leading retailers for back-to-school shopping this year will be Amazon and Walmart. And analysts expect the competition to be heated for consumer dollars, both online and in stores. And that's all the time we have today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Remember to follow our reporting online every day at nwabusinessjournal.com. I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. Many guitarists, guitar collectors, luthiers, and furniture makers are familiar with the tree. On tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, Baird Blaine tells us a bit about the legend.
It was an incredible tree that was a 10-foot diameter mahogany tree, 100-foot long log. Native loggers found it in the Chusibol jungle in Honduras in 1968, I believe, and it was such an amazing tree. With a tree, you can tell whether a tree has figure in it, which is like uncharacteristic genetics where it will grow, like the fiddleback maple is the classic where it has the waves, but not every tree has that. In the mahogany world, most trees are somewhat plain, and this tree, you can tell by the bark because it'll have spiral bark or really wavy bark. And so native loggers found this tree, knew it was special, and so they chopped it down, which is heartbreaking in right. itself, but there was some American veneer mills at the time near there that they knew they would get big money for this log. The problem was it fell in a ravine and nobody could move it.
Because it was so big, right?
Yeah. So it's lay there for 18 years until an American guy went in with bulldozers and a number of people. They basically, with chainsaws, cut it up into movable pieces, hauled it like 75 miles through the jungle to a river, floated it another 80 miles to a old steam-powered mill where it was sliced up and then brought to the States. So back in the early 80s when it came to the States, you could get it for a reasonable price. And it's this pillowy quilt figure that's almost unheard of in mahogany. I've never seen mahogany anything close to this.
It achieved legendary status.
It did.
Guitarists, luthiers, music fans have heard of
furniture.
The tree.
Furniture right. people. I believe, like, whether I don't know if it was George Lucas or Steven Spielberg, one of their offices is paneled with it. And it's just an astoundingly gorgeous tree. It's almost psychedelic in its depth.
Baird Blaine talks about the tree the instrument he was commissioned to make from some of the wood, his new concert series beginning tomorrow night at Stage 18 in Fayetteville, and we'll get to hear one of the initial performances from that guitar he created from the tree. All of that and much more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3.
On the next Fresh Air.
My name is Roger Stone, and I'm an agent provocateur.
We'll talk about political operative and Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone with Morgan Peckma, co-director of a new Netflix documentary that details Stone's political dirty tricks dating back to Richard Nixon's re-election campaign. Join us.
Fresh Air, twice every weekday on 91.3 at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m.
91.3 KUAF is supported by Highlands Oncology Group. Highlands Oncology's cancer specialists provide comprehensive, collaborative care, allowing patients and families to stay close to home. With locations in Benton and Washington counties, Highlands Oncology is helping patients fight the battle every day. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society presents the 19th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. Kansas City jazz vocalist Lisa Henry and the Claudia Burson Quartet will open the season Saturday, July 29th, and jazz guitarist Alex Wentz and his trio performs Six Strings, Six Stories, tracing the lineage of the jazz guitar, August 19th. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Poteau, Oklahoma. We will end this Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large with music from the Escape Tones. They will be at Heroes in Fort Smith on July 21st. Their most recent recording is Not Again, and a tease on their Facebook page suggests a summer release for their next album, Dead Pixels. You can learn much more about them at the Escape Tones Facebook page. This is the band, recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio, performing the title track to the previous CD release, Not Again. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening.